on House Bill 2067, and hopefully these will go fairly quickly. So we have ready to speak on that one, Charlie Stone from the Department of Forestry, and Ray, if you want to both be up there together. I'll have our...
House Bill 2067 would continue the current system of fire cost allocation in the state that was extended last session.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Charlie Stone with the Department of Forestry, Protection from Fire Program. House Bill 2067, as Beth has just said, continues the existing structure for emergency firefighting costs. In the last session, House Bill 2327 established the current setup, and it provides right now that the first $15 million of emergency firefighting cost comes out of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is primarily, well, it's entirely landowner contributions through assessment, through taxes, et cetera. If we burn through all of that in a tough fire season, then the next $10 million comes from the general fund through the emergency board. And then we have a catastrophic fire insurance policy that pays for the next $25 million after a $25 million deductible. This bill would continue that structure with the $15 million coming first from the landowners. That's set up in a two-year renewal type process. And I don't know if compromise is the right word, but the structure that was set up 2 years ago, because the legislature can't be obligated in any for any future general fund appropriations, and the system is based on a 50-50 split between landowner assessments for the regular firefighting and 50% general fund, 50% from the OFLPF to buy the insurance policy, 50% from the general fund, and then severity dollars that we use when we have difficult seasons to add to our initial attack capabilities. This two-year renewal process kind of allows the balancing of, are we going to be able to get the general fund monies to the program, and if so, then the way it's structured, the landowners continue their commitment to $15 million in the first $15 million. Otherwise, if this bill doesn't pass, then it reverts back to the earlier structure with $10 million from the landowners. The deductible on the insurance policy is still $25 million, so that then exposes the general fund to a larger gap in getting there. So that's the main purpose of this bill, is to deal with that funding structure renewal process. Then there are two other housekeeping type items that try to fix some disconnects or loopholes that we discovered during the interim. Section 2 of the bill deals with the disconnect between the landowner liability law, 477.120, and its reference to another statute that deals with additional hazards. And in essence, for a lot of years, 30 years or so, it's always been the understanding expectation that if a landowner and operator conduct an operation and they fail to notify under the Forest Practices Act, or they fail to obtain their permit under the fire prevention laws, then they can be subject to complete liability for the cost of the fire to the state forester. But in 1997, that 477.580 was amended, and they don't quite hook up right now. 120 refers to the notice in 580. There's no mention of a notice in 580, and so we're just trying to pull that back together again and restore the structure that's been there for, well, the intent that's been there for years. And then Section 3 of the bill deals with the, it's just a one-word change, the addition of the word emergency in a phrase that deals with fire suppression costs. The Emergency Fire Cost Committee is authorized by statute to set district deductibles at a certain level of firefighting that has to be paid locally by the forest protection districts before the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund reimburses for extraordinary costs. And without that word emergency in there, even though it's been administered properly for many years, someone could make the argument that the regular district costs satisfy that deductible. and in which case the fund would be paying out on fires a lot sooner and a lot more frequently than is intended and has been the practice. So again, just a housekeeping correction to make sure that nobody ever tries to drive through that loophole and change the system there. Those are the pieces to the bill. The department hopes that you'll refer it to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I have a question, but I'll wait until Ray's testimony.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Correct.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Most of you probably know, but just for the record, OFIC represents private, what's called industrial forest landowners, which is the larger forest landowners, private landowners in Oregon. Total of about, membership owns in total about 5 million acres of private forest land. As a result, as you might expect, the fire protection program, the forestry department, is very important to us. Those are valuable assets that are at risk from fire, and putting out the fires we get is very important. I think of all the good things the state of Oregon does, one of the things it does best over the years is fight forest fires. It's really a remarkable system and has worked remarkably well over the years. Exhibit A of that is that we're the only jurisdiction in the world that can get an insurance policy to help pay for suppression costs, because based on our track record, the insurance industry recognizes that's a pretty good bet for them. So that's helped our system a lot, and that insurance policy is actually directly related to this legislation and what triggered this legislation. For quite a few years, we got along pretty well with the shared responsibility in the old version, which is the landowners were responsible for the first $10 million, and then we had an insurance policy that kicked in at that point with a $10 million deductible. Because of a couple bad fire years and because of September 11th, which really roiled the insurance markets globally, that type of insurance became either not available at all or prohibitively expensive with that low of a deductible. So if we were going to continue to get insurance, we had to raise the deductible, the state. And that's what triggered the review that occurred prior to the 2005 session that resulted in this legislation that's now up for reauthorization. I was part of the committee that put that together during that interim, 03-05. There were several legislators, both Democrats and Republicans, Senate and House members, that participated in that. And I thought it was an outstanding success, the solution we came to. Some people have questioned whether and why the state pays for any of this. Why is this is private property? Why shouldn't the private landowners be responsible for it? There's a couple of responses to that. One is that a large share of these fires are caused by the public. And the second is there's a lot of public values at risk from forest fires. It's not just private values, wildlife, habitat, water quality, and that sort of thing. So traditionally, forever in Oregon, it's been viewed as a shared responsibility to protect the forest from fires, and that's, in our view, a good concept. So this bill would reauthorize the bill that passed last session. Basically, the trade-off is the increased commitment on shared responsibility. Our risk annually goes from $10 million a year to $15 million a year. That's what our risk exposure is, the maximum amount that can be charged to the landowner fund. In turn, the state agreed 2 years ago to share the cost of the insurance premium, 50-50, and also to be responsible for that second part of that deductible, up to the now $25 million deductible. So, and that, by the way, one final comment about that is that having a $25 million deductible means your premium costs are much lower than they would be with a lower deductible. So what the legislature did last time was to take that savings, basically, on insurance and plow that back into what Charlie mentioned, what's called severity funding, additional dollars that are available to the department if conditions get really bad in the summer for additional helicopters and crews and that sort of thing. That's worked extremely well. One just quick example, Representative Maurer's backyard, a 2005 fire season, the city of Cave Junction would have burned down, literally, in a really nasty fire if it hadn't been for the forestry department jumping on it really quick. And if you ever see the video of that fire, it's an amazing thing to see. But if they hadn't had the severity of money, if they hadn't had those resources on site to jump on it right away, that's what would have happened. So anyway, that's just a little bit of background on what this bill is all about, and has a strong support of the forest landowners, and we hope you'll approve it. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have a question. Beth, I noted on here it says may have a fiscal impact, no statement yet issued. what portion of, I mean, obviously there's a fiscal impact. I'm very familiar with Section 1 because we jointly together last session, you know, pressed hard to get this done earlier on, and so I'm very familiar. But is it Section 2 and Section 3? Where's the fiscal portion come from?
You know, I, Representative Oakquist, I can't answer that right now. The may have a fiscal impact statement is used when fiscal hasn't yet issued the statement. So it might be something Charlie can answer.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, Sections 2 and 3 have no fiscal impact. They're just housekeeping corrections. The fiscal impact is entirely the difference between the $15 million and the $10 million, and you can look at it one way or the other. It's almost a technical thing because if the bill passes, it's going to be the same situation next biennium as it has been this biennium, but the current law sunsets the existing, and so it is an increase of $5 million potential expenditure to the fund and the decrease of exposure to the general fund. And there's no FTE or anything.
A follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Section 3, I'm just curious here, the difference between emergency and emergency fire suppression. I mean, fire suppression is pretty emergency, I think, there, isn't it, Representative? So what was the technical fix that was required here again?
The regular district budgets pay for prevention, detection, and initial attack, and that's not considered, even though, you know, you and I would think that all fires are emergencies, that's not considered emergency fire in terms of the way that we deal with the budgets. That's part of the regular district budget. Mm-hmm. When they have an emergency fire, that means resources are required beyond the capabilities of the regular district budget, and it gets reimbursed from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund after the district expends a deductible beyond their budget. It comes back, and the landowners have to pay a higher rate the next year when they deal with that. So that's the key difference, is whether it comes out of the district budget or it comes from the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund.
Okay. And one final follow-up question. I'm just in Section 2, you're inserting the whole permitting issue here, which I'm still skimming through to see exactly what it is in relation to your testimony. But if we had been experienced in the past where we've been unable to take action against individuals, or is there some case precedents, or what led us to this position? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, I don't believe in the time period where this disconnect has existed, since 1997, that we've had any cases that fell into this particular condition. That operator fires are fairly rare in the overall cache of fires, but the language was in the 477-580 used to talk about the notice under the Forest Practices Act. In 1997, they changed it to talk about if you don't have a permit under the power-driven machinery permit under the fire laws. But nobody changed 120, and it still refers to the notice in 580. So it just left the whole thing kind of disconnected in terms of if an operator fire occurs and they haven't filed their notice under forest practices, are they going to be liable or not? If a defense attorney said, well, these two sections don't appear to have anything to do with each other, so we just want to put it back together again the way it had been for a couple decades before that, and has always been the intent that if you don't notify the state forester beforehand, then you're liable for any fires.
Follow up.
Yeah,
Mr. Chair. Because then, for the record, then I need you to clarify, because I'm very familiar with notifications, as you're familiar. However, you're saying here to obtain a permit for the use of fire in any form or power-driven machinery. I just want to clarify from you. I mean, you're not required normally when you cut wood for a chainsaw or anything like that to have a notification with you. If there's a fire season, of course, you're required to have a fire permit. I want to make sure we're clarifying that we're not adding something additional into the law on the notification requirements.
We're not adding anything additional into the law, but anytime you conduct an operation, you know, you can cut firewood on your property and that wouldn't apply, but when you conduct an operation as defined in Chapter 477, logging, improvements on the property that have to do with the commercial activity, that type of thing, then a permit is required year-round for that type of activity, and that's the permit that we're referring to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to pose this question to both the witnesses, and you can decide who should respond. When you see press accounts about firefighting out in the forests, the visuals that get the most attention are when homes are threatened. And so it's that sort of perimeter between development and the natural resource base. And what I'm curious about is how, if at all, those homeowners who want to have a house in the woods, they want to be out there because they like that living environment, to what extent do they participate in the costs of fire suppression, which tend to, at least the appearance to those of us who watch the TV news, is that a lot of resources are put at trying to keep the fire away from where they're living?
I'll take a shot at that, Representative Thurston. Two things. One is, right now in the Senate Natural Resource Committee, there's a bill that addresses that exact subject, and I think in terms of making those homes more fire safe and less of a impediment to fighting fires that occur in those interface areas, and hopefully that bill will pass and you'll get it when it gets over to this side. The other response to that is, how do they participate? The fund that we've been talking about, that's either $10 million or $15 million cost cap each year, has four different taxes that go revenues that provide the revenue stream for that fund. One of them is what's called an improved lot surcharge. It's actually the largest of the four taxes that go into that fund, and it is assessed against those people who have structures on their forested lots, and it is designed to compensate, frankly, for the complexity and the increased costs and risks associated with having those kind of mixed uses in a forest zone. So by law, they are required to help pay for the system, and also now required to do some things to minimize the risk.
Okay, and follow up, Mr. Chair? And Mr. Wilkerson, just as a matter of opinion, if you're willing to speculate, is it your sense that through that mechanism that they're bearing their share of the costs of fighting fire when it's coming at that sort of area?
I think, Representative McPherson, that's a good question. A lot of people have asked that over the years. I think, based on both of the things I just mentioned, there are legal requirements now, both in terms of helping for those folks to help pay the costs and also to help protect their own property and their surrounding property through this other bill that's in the Senate right now. I think we're certainly getting at that, but that's an open question about whether it's sufficient or not. But certainly things that we're aware of, the state's aware of, and that's being worked on those two fronts.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And it appears that we have no other testimony on this particular bill. So I would like to acknowledge a fellow representative from the Bend area,
Thank
Representative
you.
Burley. Thanks for stopping by. And
thank you.
You're welcome anytime. So
thank you.
Good to have you. So now, so we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2067 and open a hearing for House Bill 2068. So could we have Ted Lorenzen and Lisa Hansen come on up here? Short explanation.
House Bill 2068 would add the state forester or his designee to the currently existing invasive species council.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. The Invasive Species Council is administered by the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I brought with me today Dan Hilburn, who is the administrator of our plant division, who does the work with the Invasive Species Council, and I think he's probably best suited to speak to you about the work that they do and some of the background on the council, if that's acceptable to the committee.
Certainly.
For the record, my name is Dan Hilburn. I'm administrator of the plant division for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm actually wearing two hats today because I'm also the current chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council, as well as the agricultural representative on that council. The council is 5 years old now. It was created by the legislature in 2002. There are four state agencies that have permanent seats on the council: agriculture, fish and wildlife, Portland State University, and the Sea Grant College of Oregon State University. And then there are eight other members, at-large members, which represent industry, local governments, federal governments. The current membership includes a representative from the U.S. Forest Service, Gillum County Weed Control, the nursery industry, the Marine Board, the Warm Springs Indian Tribe, Linn County Soil and Water, the Nature Conservancy, and a representative from the aquaculture industry. So you can see it's a very broad group. It brings all kinds of people together to talk about invasive species and coordinate their activities, and I think it's a very important body that the state now has. The Invasive Species Council has four main functions. One of them is to increase the probability that a new invasion will be reported rapidly. And your staff member there maybe passed out the Invasive Species Council pencils. This is one way we get the word out for our toll-free number, which works whether you're reporting a new weed or a new invasive crab or a mammal or a lizard. It doesn't really matter. We have one-stop shopping for reporting in the state now. We've also developed an action plan for the state. And if there's ever money put into it, we have a bucket set aside for a trust fund to help with eradication projects. Sudden oak death is one of the huge challenges for this state right now on the invasive species front. We have several hundred acres in the Curry County area which are infected, and we've been cutting and burning those for the past 6 years. Were we to let that go, that would spread throughout the forested areas of the state where there are host plants and could really change the forest of this state. So I think that's a real example of how an invasive species can affect the forest of the state. And I think for that reason, forestry really belongs on the council as a permanent member. And I would mention some other things that are knocking on the door. We caught an Asian gypsy moth in the St. Helens area this past summer. That's a forest pest that could spread rapidly and defoliates oaks and a couple of hundred other hardwood trees. So it's not something that we want to get away. Emerald ash borer is spreading rapidly in the central part of the country. It affects ash. It's a tree killer. We have a western ash here, and it's definitely a resource that we would like to keep. And then Asian and citrus longhorn beetles have shown up in several places around the country and as close as Washington State. So there are a number of things knocking on the door. From the Department of Agriculture and the perspective of the current members of the Invasive Species Council, we urge you to send this forward with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, I'm Ted Lawrence, an assistant state forester with the Oregon Department of Forestry. Dan did a nice job providing the background on the Space of Species Council. But I also, with my testimony, handed out a colored document that really describes the condition of insect and disease issues in Oregon's forest. The Department of Forestry has had a fairly mature insect and disease program for a long time. But what we found is that invasive species are becoming an increasing problem on forest lands. And indeed, as the Board of Forestry looked at issues they needed to address over the coming years in working with the public to identify those issues, both forest landowners and a range of other interest groups identified invasive species as a major threat to forest lands for all the reasons, including economic, social, and environmental, that these pests can cause problems with. Dan talked about sudden oak death. We are very aggressive about that. But you just heard the testimony about the fire program, and this is a program that's very similar to that. If it's going to be effective, we've got to have early detection, we've got to have aggressive suppression action, and we've got to have good follow-through in terms of making sure that we're successful. Our involvement on the Invasive Species Council for the activities that are listed would help make forest lands be a player in the process that we need to be, and we look forward to your approval of this bill. I think the pamphlet I passed out, I would encourage you to read it. I think it provides lots of good information.
We believe that the invasive species do reflect a real tipping point for Oregon. And it's worth not just noting that this is an issue about new invasives. We have a number of invasives on forest land, such as Scotch broom and blackberry, that have caused serious economic problems for many years, and we need to address those issues as well. So there's lots of work to do, and we look forward to our formal participation on this committee.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, yes. Yes, first question is, Beth, I'm assuming we're waiting for a fiscal impact statement on this one, too, which is why we're not. Roger that, Mr. Chair. question of whoever on the panel wants to answer, if you would, Mr. Chair. Can somebody define to me voting ex officio member? I mean, an ex officio member is an ex officio member. And,
yeah, right.
And maybe the esteemed counsel on my far left, appropriate place for Representative McPherson. Can somebody define this? I mean, what is a voting ex officio member?
I'll take a shot at that, Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist. I believe the reason that is in there is because further on in the bill it refers to a non-voting ex officio member, which would be the invasive species coordinator position. And that position is a part of the budget that the department has submitted, the governor's budget, but there, up until this point there hasn't been a coordinator, even though it was set up with the original bill. So that person would be a non-voting ex officio member.
I'd be happy to offer up a
hey, Mr.
View.
Chair, I would ask the esteemed counsel of the committee.
Only just drawing on sort of general experience, that there's nothing inconsistent with being an ex officio member of something and being a voting member. That is, the ex officio simply means by virtue of being in a position, you are automatically a member of that body. Mm-hmm. And that can be either voting or non-voting, depending on what the makeup of that body is.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Now that counselors got me going here. in one of the members' panel, appointing authority, who is the president appointing authority? And I did note farther along, members of industry, so on and so forth. What's the makeup of the committee now, and who is the existing appointing authority?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, the current appointing authority are the four permanent members. So the Director of Agriculture, the President of Portland State University, State Fish and Wildlife Director, and the Administrative Head of the Sea Grant College of Oregon State University. The way the law currently reads, each of them appoints two of the at-large members. But because of the math, if you add a fifth permanent member, you can't have each of them appointing two without increasing the overall size of the committee beyond what the bill would like to do, which is just to add one new person to the council.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair? Yeah. And the second half of my question, which I believe if I looked on here, it's supposed to include members of federal government agency, local universities, industry, so on and so forth. Who are the industry appointees and who are the other members? If you would, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Mr. Chair, Representative, would you like the names or the organizations that they represent?
I don't necessarily need the names. I'm talking about where are we talking about. Do we actually have farmers on here? Do we have foresters on here? Do we have all employees of the state of Oregon and other government agencies on the committee?
We have one U.S. Forest Service representative who's an entomologist. We have a Gillum County Weed Control, so a county weed specialist. We have a nurseryman representing the nursery industry. We have a state employee representing the Marine Board. We have a biologist representing the Warm Springs Indian Tribe. We have a Linn County Soil and Water Conservation biologist. We have a botanist from the Nature Conservancy and a person who raises oysters from the aquaculture industry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for whoever wants to answer this, and I'm a bit perplexed, actually, why you weren't appointed to this from the beginning, because you know a big part of the invasive species problem affects forests. But
If you can explain who sets the list or who determines what plants can or cannot be sold in the state of Oregon, because I am really amazed that I can still go to Home Depot and buy English ivy, Japanese knotweed, you know, a whole host of invasive species that have, I mean, you know, have taken over, especially in riparian areas. I mean, the only good thing about Japanese knotweed I can figure out is it's out-competing Himalayan blackberry. But I can't understand why we still sell this. And for somebody who represents the city of Portland, we have the largest urban park in the nation, and our forest is being threatened tremendously by ivy infestation. So maybe you can illuminate for us how plants get on, or, you know, a list that can or cannot be sold in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, there's two parts to the answer here. One is that the Invasive Species Council maintains a list of the 100 most dangerous invaders threatening the state. So those are things that don't currently exist in the state and we're trying to keep out. So that's an exclusionary list. It does not involve any quarantines or restrictions on what's already here. The Department of Agriculture does have a prohibited list for plants, and both of the plants that you mentioned, English ivy and knotweed, are on there. But English ivy is only on there for the wild type heterohelix, not the horticultural varieties, for instance, variegated leaves, or there's miniature leaves, or there's many, many other horticultural varieties which have been bred for the horticulture trade and are not invasive the way the wild type is. So I suspect what you're seeing is not wild type English ivy, which is prohibited. And if you do see it, you should give me a call.
I'll make sure I get your number. Okay. Follow-up question. Yeah. But now, do you make recommendations to the ODA about plants that need to be added to? I didn't hear what's the connection between the two.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, there's a state weed board which actually controls the state noxious weed list. They recommend to the department what should go on the quarantine list. So the process is for the state weed board to put something on a watch list, which then gets a risk assessment done. The risk assessment, if it turns out to be something that we don't want to have in the trade, then it goes on the state noxious weed list. And from that list, the department updates its quarantine list every year.
If I may, Chair Roland, Representative Dingfelter, in addition to the state's effort, there are federal requirements and programs in place, and particularly with insects, the USDA, through their APHIS program, has an early detection effort and that we're engaged in a number of arenas. I think your point's well taken, and I guess kind of our closing comment or testimonies, we would very much like to work with this or another committee to address the invasive species issues more broadly, but with regard to this bill, we think it's a good first step. Certainly, there are a whole host of issues that come with invasive species, and sustaining early detection, sustaining suppression and eradication efforts are really important, but there certainly is the management choice, and sod's a good example. And we'd be happy to bring some very detailed information on that. But you look at Humboldt County in California, where 4 years ago sod looked like what it did in Curry County, just a few patches scattered around the forest. That's exploded. It looks like the biscuit fire now. It's just gone rampant. And they've lost their options. And we really need to think about how we're going to handle these sorts of things. And it certainly is an issue with regard to aquatic species and a whole host of other topics as well that we really don't address very well. So from a policy perspective, we'd be more than happy to work with you further on this topic. Okay. Thank you.
Chair, just one final comment or questions. So do we have kudzu in the state yet? I went to graduate school in North Carolina, so I'm intimately familiar with kudzu.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't anymore. We had three sites, and we have eradicated them. This is the second year without any regrowth, so we define that as eradication. So we used to, but we don't anymore.
Good news. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
question?
Yes. There may be another bill or topic or more appropriate time, but I'm interested in the Scotch broom problem and what the, you know, I mean, is it just human power to go deal with it because it's so difficult and money and or, you know, it's something, you know, I finally get a position to ask these questions.
I'm going to, since that's not germane to this,
yeah, that's fine.
One,
yeah.
We will bring it up in a different.
Okay,
we'll bring the weed board here and we'll have some other people talk about it in the future.
Good.
Time.
I believe Councilor has a question.
I'm sorry?
Did you have a question?
No.
Oh.
Yeah. I do have a follow-up question, Mr. Chair. I just want to confirm, and you mentioned earlier the members. There's three of the 12 existing members are from the public or from the private sector. Is that correct? Three of the existing 12 or four of the existing 12?
Nurseries, Oyster Growers.
For the record, Lisa Hansen. As I look at the list, it looks like there are two that are from industry.
Right.
The Warm Springs Tribe, I would consider as a public member as well on this. So three. I'm not sure how you would want to define the weed control district.
I think someone from one of the conservation organizations was on there too, right? That would be a private entity. That's a private entity.
Nonprofit.
Yeah. A follow-up question?
Yes,
sure. I had wrote it down here.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2068. And now we'd like to open an informational hearing on the reauthorization extension of the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act of 2000.
That's obviously what we're
And what I guess we'd like to do here, there's a number of people here to speak, and some of them have time constraints. So I'm looking at the clock and trying to figure out how best to do that. We have a group of people.
Just the whole group.
Gil, yeah.
So we've got Gil and Dave Barrows and Mary Lockton, Dave Williams, and John Punches. I guess they can all come up and go on. And I know that Dave has an issue with some time, is it working okay? That took a little longer than I thought it was going to. And Mary has a little issue with time. You know, we're going to let Gil forward, go right off the bat, if we can. And for a lot of people, I think everybody knows what's going on, but, you know, this is our world newspaper in my hometown, and the big issue was timber payments dilemma, cut jobs, and hope of a bailout. There's a lot of discussion going on, and I just felt we need to have the discussion. We will look at in the future, memorial or something. We did one last session. It's in drafting now, but I just wanted to get this out here, and I knew there were a lot of people in the area ready to talk about this issue. So with that, Gil.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Gil Rebell, Policy Manager, Association of Oregon Counties. You're receiving a small packet that I provided to give you a statewide perspective of the impacts that now threaten us. Secure Rural Schools, as the chair has said, has expired, and with it has gone $200 million a year to Oregon's counties and $62 million a biennium to the state school system. Now, why is this a state issue besides the fact that it deals with school funds? Well, this first sheet I gave you is a color chart of the role that counties play. Not only do counties represent the same constituency that you do, but we provide policy and delivery of many of the services that you do. So we're joined at the hip for that. If we can't perform any of these functions, then you have to decide whether they'll continue. The second chart that I provided is the impacts, you'll see that, let me put this into context. There's a general fund group here of columns and a road fund group. The general fund, you'll notice if you go to the last column under the general fund group, the general fund percent loss without PL 106393, which is the public law number for the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. You'll see that the total loss statewide to counties is 12.3% in annual discretionary revenues. Let me put that into context. In the biennium of 2001-2003, the state suffered a decline in general fund revenues that was considered catastrophic, and it was the most since the Great Depression. That shortfall was 13%. Now, if you remove Washington and Multnomah counties from this list, that 12.3% grows to 20% per year for the other 34 counties, on average, of general fund loss. The roads are already at 20%. You don't have to take Multnomah or Washington out to get that. And that's in the last column. Okay, so why don't the counties just raise property taxes and make up the difference? Well, one problem is in the third column over, permanent rate authority. When the voters adopted Measure 50, they put into the Constitution the rates that were in place then for jurisdictions. County jurisdictions have a wide variety of rates. And you'll notice, for example, Curry County is a mere 60 cents per thousand of taxable property. That's permanent. That's permanent. They can't go to the voters and ask for that to change. It's in the Constitution, in effect. Okay, why don't they go for local option taxes and just work their way out, grow their way out? Well, the second column shows the percent of state and federal ownership. This is non-taxable property by county. And you'll notice that 18, that is half the counties, have greater than 40% non-taxable ownership. So they have limited ability to grow their way out if they could at all. So, okay, you can't use the property tax. The federal government has expired in its responsibility to these counties and schools. Why don't you just go back to the shared formula, the old traditional shared method? Well, that's the third. The red bars are what Oregon has received. Oregon counties have received from the Secure Rural Schools Act. The green bar is what we would have received under the old traditional method without the safety net. We're going to the green bar. We're going from the red bar to the green bar. So that's our situation.
Any questions before we get to the next testimony? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. Gil sort of leaves us all speechless. but the only thing that is worse than Gil's presentation is my phone messages and my emails. We represent 24 of the 36 counties most severely hit by this what can only be considered an economic crisis and dilemma that Oregon's going to face. You know, I'm not gonna do what Gil does well, which is talk about numbers. What I want to talk about is the fact that we have thousands of members across this state right now who are at this very moment receiving pink slips or layoff notices. And if you look at the economy of rural Oregon, there are two types, or well, maybe two and a half types of family wage jobs in rural Oregon. One is natural resource based. The second is fishing or ocean based. And the third is public employment. The natural resource based family wage jobs have been all but decimated across this state with a lockdown of the forests and a decline in the timber industry and a decline in a lot of the natural resource jobs that we had at one time. When you combine that with now a loss of public employment, what you're talking about is absolute devastation that I don't know how these cities and counties recover from it. I don't know where Coos County turns for a new job base once both the natural resource base has been destroyed and now public employment as well. And I remember when the casino in Coos County was a sawmill. You know, I knew people who worked there. You know, I don't know what you turn the juvenile parole office into. If we open another casino, there just won't be anybody to go there unless we bring in more Californians. And I'm not sure that's the solution. Not knowing where everybody's from, I'll leave it there. You know, I think the important thing is that our union for many, many years has been sort of at the forefront with counties and with the industry in trying to find long-term solutions to the timber funding issue. We were part of the group that went to D.C. that originally put the safety net together with ONC with the ONC counties folks. We are prepared to do that again. The difference today is that when we put together the safety net, we had some influence in the White House. That would not be the case any longer. So we will need to have a different kind of a coalition to influence the decisions that are being made. And we are prepared to do what we can with the Democrats who are now in control of the U.S. Congress and the Senate. But it's going to require that all of us, sort of put our differences aside and step up. Because this is a death knell for some of these counties that they will never, just simply never recover from, or may not recover from for decades. And I just don't know where we go if we don't figure out a way to move forward together. And our congressional delegation and our Senate delegation, our senators aren't the problem. Our congressional delegation isn't the problem. What we need to do is send a message to other states that they need to help us this time. And, you know, we need to find some long-term solutions. You know, maybe we need to open up the forests a little bit. I know that that's like, you know, not a popular statement to make, but maybe we do need to take a look at a way of opening up the forest so that we can rebuild the timber industry and create some new family wage jobs. We certainly have to do something. We have to do something in the short term, which is to get the reauthorization, in the long term, which is to find better solutions. And, you know, unless we figure out a way to make Coos Bay closer to the Portland International Airport, I'm thinking that we need to find something that we can do in Coos Bay all on its own that makes a difference down there and doesn't depend on Portland metropolitan area to keep it going. So having said that, we just urge you to do whatever you can to join with the rest of us in sending a message to D.C. that this is a statewide problem and that there are a lot of partners willing to work together that have not always worked together on issues like this.
Thank you. Dave? And Gil, we might have some questions for you afterwards, but thanks.
Yeah, we're switching.
And I also miss Amy Wilson. She's going to be up here, too, at some point. So.
Talk about a rose between two
thorns. I'm sorry. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for recognizing my time issue. I'll be very brief. I'm Dave Barrows. I've been the lobbyist, twice the executive director, a number of things, for more than 40 years with the Association of ONC Counties. And for those of you who may not be intimately familiar with that, these are essentially the west side counties in Oregon that get timber receipts from BLM lands as opposed to national forest lands. And these are about the only timber lands the BLM manages of any substance in the nation. It's a very special deal that instead of 25% going to the counties, as does off the national forest lands, counties get 50% of the receipts. It's unique to Oregon, even though the name is Oregon and California. It's the way the railroad was named. Mary put it very well. Gil put it very well. It's a severe crisis. It's not a crisis that we haven't seen coming. This legislature unanimously last session adopted a memorial with a whole range of the folks that Mary talked about that don't always work well together on issues, but did on this one because we're all in the same boat. The horrors that face some of the southwest counties especially, but even Clackamas County, with all due respect to my good state representative, loses $10 million. Now, $10 million at Clackamas County is not like losing $10 million in Curry County, but it's a noticeable hurt. Things go awry as a result. And some of these two of the counties that lose almost 70% of their general fund money. And all we're here to do is to say we're grateful for the interest the legislature has shown in this in the past. The ONC counties have spent a considerable sum of money with consultants and other folks in D.C. We have a person in D.C. that we have on a retainer who does nothing but try to find places that we can pay for this. Because under the federal budgeting requirements, as you are all very familiar with, you don't just pass a bill, you have to have the money. This was adopted in a time, the 1 year that we've had a budget surplus in the last however many long years, and now we don't. So it's a critical situation. The ONC counties continue to pledge to do whatever they can, wherever they have to go. Our people spend a ton of time in Washington, D.C., and Mary's point is well taken. It's not our delegation. Our delegation is fine. They're great. They're working hard. They are all committed. And we're in unique positions. Senator Wyden is really the focal point at this point. I'm not trying to put anything in any pocket, but the fact of the matter is he's chair of the forestry subcommittee. And so he's a major player in this discussion. So we have to do the things that Mary talked about. Our governor has shown leadership and called a meeting. There was a meeting yesterday on this subject, and so we just urge you to do whatever you can to add your voice in conversations with our delegation and with anybody you know from outside Oregon. 39 states benefit from this program. The difficulty is Oregon gets half the money. So it's compelling to us. It's nice for many others. For others and for Washington and Northern California, it's very important, too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Barrett.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I must say this is a privilege. I think this is the first time I've ever appeared before the Ag and Natural Resources Committee in any of the previous iterations. Quite a treat for me. But representing the Oregon School Boards Association as I do, again, David Williams for the record, this really is also a schools issue, as Gil tried to point out. There is a large impact to schools around the state, and as the county dollars are really focused on a county-by-county basis, because of the way the school funding formula works in this state, all of the dollars that go to schools are offset in that formula. So the impact is not just to rural schools, it is to every school district in the state of Oregon on an equal per-student share. So we are of keen interest in this issue as well, have been to Washington, D.C. a number of times with our partners, and are looking to do all that we can as well to prop this issue up and make sure that it gets the attention it deserves. While $31 million a year or $62 million biennially may not sound like very much in a $6 billion, $6.3 billion state budget for schools, or an $8-plus billion state and local funds budgets for schools, we all know the times that we are in right now and the stress is placed on our education system. So every dollar counts for districts around the state. You know, $3 million for Portland Public in the size of their budgets is not a lot of money, much though as $10 million to Clackamas County may not seem like a lot of money compared to their whole budget. $10 million is a lot of valuable program for these districts and these counties, and we couldn't be more honored to support our coalition partners in this and find every effort we can to restore this program.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Amy Wilson, and I'm here representing SEIU. And most folks just don't know that SEIU represents approximately 3,500 local government workers. We're in Marion, Lynn, Josephine, Jackson, Baker, Umatilla, and Wallala counties. And we're representing a variety of workers in these counties. And I think that everything that Mary said was what we would echo. One example that comes to mind for us specifically is we represent the workers in Jackson County, and I think Gil had talked about the possibility of closing 15 libraries throughout the county. And those are jobs that disappear and don't come back. as well as what does it mean to not have a library. And so we've been working with our congressional delegation and with our local partners, and we're excited to be here and talking about this. And again, it's not so much the Oregon delegation that's the issue, but there's, you know, for Oregon to be able to continue to get these funds, you know, there's some real urgency on the part of our workers. Thank you.
Thank you. So, questions for people? What I really want, I guess the question that I'd ask, and I'd ask it of Gil as anybody, you know, we have seen this coming for 6 years or so or longer. We knew that it was possibly going to happen. And you look at your chart and you realize there really aren't very many places you can go out and get this kind of money. The tax structure that we have in place right now makes that very, very difficult. I am hearing, and I expect we will get bills here, with different people coming up with lots of different ideas to go about how do we find resources. What are the counties doing that you know of to try to find other replacement resources, if there are anything, or... I guess OMC counties, I could ask that question of too.
We're doing everything.
But I mean, even from the state level.
Yes, yeah. Mr. Chair, Gil Verdale, again for the record. We have a policy committee within AOC of commissioners who are exploring some short-term stopgap kinds of mitigations plus long-term structural changes that might go to the revenue-raising system, the public finance system in the state. We have 8 counties that have successfully adopted, in spite of all the impediments, local option taxes. Local option taxes are limited, however, in time. They can't be longer than 5 years. They're subject to Measure 5 compression. They're subject to the double majority requirements. So it's really remarkable we have 8 counties that managed to raise $81 million to mitigate against the cuts. They may expire, and they will expire, and the voters may not renew those. We have asked, we made a series of presentations with the Ways and Means Committee, subcommittees yesterday, and asked that one of the things that we requested was set up some kind of mechanism where we can continue to have a discussion about this across government relations, across the county and state families, because it's highly complex. We've got 36 different situations, because each county is in a different situation for different reasons. We have a past president who said very adroitly, if you've seen one Oregon county, you've seen one Oregon county. And it makes this a very complex issue to solve.
Thank you. And John, I had missed you before, so from the OSU Extension Agency.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for taking time to work on this important issue. My name is John Punches, and I'm with Extension Service. I am stationed in Douglas County, which is Roseburg, if you need. You know, Extension provides an important range of services, not only in rural counties and communities, but also in urban ones. We have programs that run the gamut from youth development to wildlife stewards to a host of services and programs to help farmers, ranchers, and foresters manage natural resources wisely. We hope that we're contributing to the economic base and allowing people to more effectively manage their resources and have healthy families and productive communities. But when something like this comes along, it's awful hard to kind of see the bright side of things. We're, through Extension Service, probably going to see elimination of Extension offices in a number of counties around the state, because when counties are faced with losses of up to 70% of their operating base, there's just no way for them to support any type of program, no matter how valuable it may be. And so we're certainly going to see losses in those particular counties. If I can give a Douglas County example, last year alone, Douglas County, which is one of the largest receivers of these funds anywhere in the country, had $43.5 million come in from the Fair Rural Schools and Communities Act. Of that, about $24 million comes out of ONC dollars, so it goes directly into the county's general fund budget. Folks, that's 59% of Douglas County's budget. And you might say, well, they can just go out and raise taxes. Even if we could, our tax base is only 6% of the budget. So there's simply no place to go. Douglas County is going to be decimated by this. And the question that comes before you is, what can the state legislature do about it? And so, you know, I know you don't have direct impact over how this bill takes shape at the federal level, but certainly if you know people, if you have connections, if you can make known the implications of this at county level and at the state level, there's anything we can do. We must work together to help address this. There are certainly implications of this that are going to go beyond the direct activities or involvement at the county level. As Mr. Williams pointed out, any change in the funding for the Common Schools Fund is going to impact every school in the state. When Douglas County loses its piece there, that's going to be a $5 million per year loss in revenues to the schools fund. So it affects every place. We've really got to work together to try to find ways out of this. And really the best thing that I can offer today is that Extension, through its connections with the university and through our connections with people around the state, we're posed pretty well to help you and help others address this issue. So I would encourage you to call upon us. We're excellent at gathering information, at synthesizing, at making sense out of difficult situations. We know these communities. We work with these people who are going to be affected all the time in a variety of contexts, and we'd like to do all that we can to help address these issues in a meaningful manner. Thank you for taking time, and I'll address any questions.
Any questions? Yes.
I have a question, Gil, if you mind bringing it back. Sure.
Sure.
Hey, Gil, you may not know the answer here, and I'm actually looking at the technical aspects here. I mean, the loss of funds under 106.393 is based on, you know, the fiscal year, federal fiscal year 06, and of course their forecasted revenue receipts. Do they come in sometime after 06? What I'm kind of looking for is, I mean, just hypothetically, it'll take Baker County. Well, Douglas is a good example, or Curry, some of the tie up there. How are they cash flowing their existing operations? Do some of these receipts actually come in after the fiscal year, even though they received the fiscal year? Or is it just as of 1 October, nothing else came, and now they're just operating on what money they had left?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, the last payment has arrived, both for the ONC lands and the National Forest lands. The counties are now beginning their budget cycle for the next county fiscal year without this money.
Well, I mean, yes. You said last week, did it arrive first quarter of
It arrived 07? In December and January. One came, the BLM was quicker than the Forest Service, okay. But they have been issued and banked.
So basically now the last checks arrived in January, and now if the counties are continuing to do maintenance funds, hypothetically on roads, especially in some of these that are at 59-60%, they're just going to be using general fund dollars, and magically at 2, 3, 4, 5 months from now, they're going to run out of money and there won't be any potholes filled. Well,
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, the counties that are hurt the worst in the road fund do not have general funds to backfill. They just are not in that position. What we've heard from counties is that they're not filling positions. They have ramped down to bare maintenance. That some of the counties are having to ignore certain of the roads that don't have bus routes, for example, for schools. I mean, one gets the feeling we're in the Great Depression in some of these places, frankly.
Well, Mr. Chair, we are in a Great Depression in some of these places.
Yeah,
we need to do something about it.
Yep. Well, I look forward to working with all of you to come up with a solution at the federal level, and then also to look here at the state level and find solutions, you know, that we can come up with. And there's a lot of people out there talking about different kinds of things, and I know there's a lot of county people and groups of people trying to figure out what can we do to come up with revenues. So, yes.
If I may, Dave Barrows, ONC Counties. When this was enacted 6 years ago, AFSCME, SEIU, the National Education Association was a very strong partner in getting this enacted. Different party occupied the White House then. There was, I indicated earlier, a budget surplus. It was a very different, I wouldn't say easier ball game, but it was a very different ball game because it was kind of a new thrust. There had been a safety net just for the coastal, Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. but there the spotted owl counties, as it were. But there had never been a national rollout of this effort, and it was our national partners that played a great role in that. And you've heard local spokespersons for both of those. And I just want to conclude my comments by saying that we are very grateful that, in spite of sometimes not seeing the world through the same prism, that we are working shoulder to shoulder with the governor, with a wide range of folks. And again, we have we've put lots of resources on the ground in Washington. And our dependence on this is both the good news and the bad news. It's been good news that it's been here for the 6 years. The bad news is we're the ones most affected if it doesn't get reauthorized by June 30th.
And I guess the other question I would have is, prior to all of this happening, when we were harvesting timber in these counties on this property that was there, what was the agreement with the federal government and with the counties with respect to the timber that was taken off those federal forests? Do you remember?
Can we address that? The previous arrangement, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the previous arrangement was that on Forest Service lands, 25% of revenues were earmarked to go back to the counties, and they were then further, I believe by state law, designated to go either into road funds, 75% into road funds, and 25% into the school fund. With the funds that come from Bureau of Land Management lands, which is both ONC lands and something known as the Coos Bay Wagon Road. So both of those were originally lands that had been allocated to these companies that were either going to build roads or build railroads. And when they defaulted on some of their obligations, they revested back to the federal government. But when the enabling acts were put in place to assure management of those, they were set aside for sustained yield management with a specific language in there representing that they would produce timber and that the proceeds would be one half of that would go back to the counties to support their local budgets. It's kind of an in lieu of taxes situation. And if we go back to that now, just for another Douglas County example, we'd go from $48.5 million to something less than $5 million. The rates of harvest in Douglas County, with which I'm familiar, are less than one-tenth of what they were prior to the Northwest Forest Plan.
Other questions?
No, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you all.
I just wanted to thank you for holding this hearing. I mean, it's really important we keep the spotlight on this as much as possible, and I know that's what today was about. So yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I do have a comment between the committee members. I mean, we look at the overall problem, and relying on the federal government is, considering the fact we've got had on the ONC lands consistently time and time again, and of course we did a memorial last session. I think every member that was here, sitting here last session, voted for it, and absolutely unanimous. But, you know, at some point, you know, as a body, we're going to have to scratch our heads and say, what are we going to do in the bridging function here? Because some of these counties are going to fall. I mean, and they're going to fall in the public service. The roads are going to fall. The interstate system, I mean, it doesn't take a whole lot of deal to figure out the interconnection between city, county, and states. And the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of contracted joint services in here that will be vastly impacted. And that becomes, you know, a ways and means question downstairs. I mean, do you do a one-time bridging mechanism or what do we do? I mean, it's pretty hard for us to sit here and look at a budget, whether it's going up by 22% or whatever it is, so on and so forth, and talk about new programs or expansions when we have some, you know, critical, absolutely critical basic services in counties that, you know, we're on a hope and a prayer thinking the federal government's going to help us. So.
And my concern is that even anything we do bridging, we still need to have resources for these counties to exist. And we can bridge it for a short period of time, but somehow replacement funds need to be found within our borders. And when you look at some of these counties that are over 60% own, actually 78% Lake County, is in federal or other ownership. They don't have a tax base. There's no way for them to get money the way normal counties get it. with respect to roads and those other kinds of things that they have. So somehow we're going to have to look at this system as a legislator if we don't want those counties to fail. Okay. Any other questions? Anybody else that we didn't have speak that would like to say a word before we close the hearing? Well, I thank everybody, and we will close our informational meeting. And thank you all.
Committee as well.
Pardon me, the committee.